Richard Duncan from Macro Watch. How are you? Thanks for joining me today.
Tom, great. Thank you for inviting me back.
Really great to have you on the Competent Investor here. Of course, we've spoken several times before. You're the author of several books, one of which we discussed the last time. And a lot of it was about really around this idea of a strategy that you came up with that really is trying to, let's say, kickstart the US with growth by spending. You know, we've spoken several times before. You come at this from an interesting angle. In a lot of respects, it's, let's say, counterintuitive to, you know, a lot of Austrian folks, but I appreciate being able to think about these things from a very different, let's say, orthogonal perspective the way you do. So I appreciate, you know, the way that you do consider these things.
Okay, thanks. Yes, that book was called The Money Revolution: How to Finance the Next American Century. Mm-hmm. It came out in 2022.
So today, Richard, I thought we could kind of focus a lot more on some of your thoughts for, let's say, the next moves for Trump, and specifically how he, in a way, could make himself Fed chairman. So why don't we start with what Trump thinks monetary policy should be versus the current course that Powell has held in Trump's term so far?
Okay, well, let's start with a very, very big picture and then discuss how Trump's strategy is going to affect what has been going on for the last several decades. In my opinion, the most important macroeconomic development of my lifetime has been the emergence of the United States' massive current account deficit starting in the 1980s. Before then, the current account deficit is similar to the trade deficit. Before then, the United States didn't have a trade deficit because as long as we were on the Bretton Woods system or a gold standard system, trade between countries had to balance. Because if one country had a big deficit with another country, it would have to pay for that deficit with its gold, and it would run out of gold, and so it would stop buying things from other countries, and trade came back into balance. So there were no trade deficits of any magnitude before the early 1980s. Bretton Woods broke down in 1971, and it took a little while for the United States to discover that it could start buying things, you know, extraordinarily large amounts of goods from other countries, and it no longer had to pay with gold. It could pay with U.S. dollars that were not backed by gold or treasury bonds that were not backed by gold. And so the United States started running a massive trade deficit in the mid-1980s, and that has completely transformed the global economy and the United States economy in major ways. It's completely transformed the way the world economy works. It's in the total current account deficit since the 1980, the cumulative U.S. current account deficit has been $17 trillion. That's pumped $17 trillion into the trade surplus countries and created countries. It's turned China into a superpower, for instance. China would still be a very poor developing country if it had not had such a massive trade surplus with the United States over all these years. And the same can be said for all of the Asian miracle countries. I started my career in Hong Kong in 1986 and have spent most of my career here in Asia. And I've watched this transformation of Asia firsthand. It's grown miraculously mm-hmm. as a result of U.S. current account deficit, which was their surplus. Now, at the same time, while this trade surplus in Asia has pulled hundreds of millions of people out of poverty and created a great global economic boom, it's also benefited the United States in many ways. For instance, when the U.S. buys goods from countries with very low-cost labor, that drives down the cost of those goods. And so it's disinflationary. It brings down the inflation rate in the United States. In the early 1980s, the inflation rate was in the double digits. And so interest rates were in the double digits. But as the U.S. trade deficit became larger and larger, that was very disinflationary. And the inflation rate came down very sharply, and interest rates came down very sharply. During most of this century, the inflation rate in the United States has been below the Fed's 2% inflation target rather than above it. And that's because of globalization. So lower inflation, lower interest rates. Lower interest rates help create the booming stock market and help fuel the economy because, of course, low interest rates help people borrow and consume and help businesses borrow and invest. And so that has created quite a big economic boom in the U.S. as well during this century. However, President Trump is focused on the negative aspects of what has resulted from globalization and this massive U.S. current account deficit. And that is, it has deindustrialized the United States, and it's resulted in the hollowing out of the U.S. middle class. And he's determined to reverse all that. And so what he's describing, Make America Great Again, this involves reindustrialization of the United States. And also what he wants to see is the United States current account deficit come back into balance. So last year, the current account deficit was $1.2 trillion. Now, if the current account begins to come back into balance, if he actually succeeds in bringing the current account back into balance, this is going to completely end and reverse the most dominant trend in the global macroeconomic scene of my lifetime. As I said, a complete reversal of the macroeconomic paradigm. So that's what I'd like to discuss with you today, his strategy and what the consequences could be and also the opportunities of this.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a balance, I think, to be had there, both the consequences and the opportunities. So going back to this idea, basically, of Trump in a way kind of becoming, let's say, de facto Fed chair or shadow Fed chair, How could he go about this? How has he already in some ways started to dismantle the Fed, let's say starting with Lisa Cook and the accusation against her of mortgage fraud, if people remember that?
Okay, well, before we jump on toward the president taking over the Fed, let's discuss his strategy to make America great again. He does have a strategy. It's very clear cut. And in fact, much of this strategy was laid out in a paper by Stephen Moran, who is concurrently the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors to the president, now temporarily on leave, and the most recently appointed Fed governor, Stephen Moran. In November last year, he published a paper called A User's Guide to Restructuring the Global Trading System, I believe it was called. And in that paper, he presented very clearly what turned out to be a blueprint for President Trump's trade and tariff strategy. This blueprint, it was a three-step strategy that he laid out in this paper with two objectives. Let's discuss the three-step strategy first. Step number one was to put very high trade tariffs on all of the United States trading partners. Step number two was to threaten all of the United States trading partners that we would no longer defend them militarily if they retaliated against the tariffs. In other words, in the case of Europe, for instance, that the threat was the U.S. would no longer defend Europe from Russia if Europe dared to retaliate against the high trade tariffs. And then the final step was to convene all of these terrified trading partners in what Stephen Moran described as a Mar-a-Lago accord, in which they would all agree to a sharp devaluation of the dollar against their currencies, as well as agreeing to put up very high trade tariffs against China, just like the U.S. would be doing, in order to isolate China behind a global tariff wall, more or less. Now, so what we've seen so far, the objective of this was to reindustrialize the United States and to stop China's economy from growing so it would no longer be such a threat to U.S. national security. So what we've seen so far is step one has been carried out. We put up very high trade tariffs on everyone. Step two has been carried out. We threatened to no longer defend our allies if they don't fall in line and do what we tell them to do. And so now step number three is probably taking place behind the scenes. There's a lot of pressure on other countries to allow the dollar to be devalued. And so that's been quite an incredible blueprint for what's been happening so far. So that was one part of the paper, chapter three on tariffs. And chapter four was on currency. And the currency strategy was to get the dollar down, to devalue the dollar. President Trump has said again and again that he wants the dollar to fall in order to help bring U.S. trade back into balance. So that's been a really useful user's guide to understanding what President Trump has in mind. Mm-hmm. Now, there are problems with this, of course. This U.S. trade deficit has been the fuel that's been fueling the global economy for decades. As I mentioned earlier, last year, the U.S. current account deficit was $1.2 trillion. So that pumped out $1.2 trillion into the global economy, into the surplus countries. Now, that benefited clearly the surplus countries, but it also benefited the United States as follows. The countries who obtained that $1.2 trillion through their trade surplus, they sold their goods in the United States, they were paid in dollars, they took the dollars back home, wherever home is, China mostly, and they had dollars. And they had to do something with those dollars. They had an extra $1.2 trillion last year. And because they have dollars, they have to invest those dollars into U.S. dollar-denominated assets, things like U.S. government bonds or U.S. stocks. And so that money came boomeranging back into the United States. When they bought government bonds, that pushed up the bond price and it pushed down the bond yields. And of course, when they bought stocks, that helped push the stock market to higher and higher levels, as we've been seeing. Now, the trouble is, if President Trump actually does succeed in bringing the current account deficit back into balance, then first of all, the trade surplus countries will all suffer because they will be earning less money and their factories will not be working at full capacity by some long measure, and unemployment will go up. And that will result in less money going into their banks, and so less credit creation and less economic growth abroad. But it will also mean that there will be fewer dollars being reinvested back into the United States. So if other countries buy fewer government bonds, then government bond prices will tend to move down and interest rates will tend to move up. And at the same time, if the U.S. buys fewer things from other countries with low wages, then that's going to tend to push up the price of goods in the United States, and that will be inflationary. And that will also push up interest rates again in the United States. We've already seen the inflation rate beginning to move up. It's now, the CPI is about 2.9%, considerably above the Fed's 2% target, and it's moving in the wrong direction, and it's probably going to continue going higher. So these are the challenges that President Trump is facing in pulling off this strategy to reindustrialize the United States. So a key part of what must be done if he's going to be successful in this is he really, really needs to take control of the Federal Reserve and take over control of U.S. monetary policy. And here's where Lisa Cook comes in. The reason he needs to take over the Federal Reserve is because his policies are inflationary. If the United States stops buying goods from countries with extremely low cost labor and starts making them in the United States, it's going to be much more expensive to make those goods. Not only in a first round effect, we have tariffs now on practically every country in the world. So the tariffs push up the cost of those goods that before didn't have tariffs on them. That's inflationary in a first round effect. But also there will be a second round effect that will also be inflationary. If the United States begins manufacturing more of these goods inside the United States, then that's going to result in an increased demand for American workers. Of course, that will be good for American workers and for their wages, but the U.S. already has a labor shortage. The unemployment rate is only 4.3%, which is very low by past standards. If we begin a manufacturing boom and hiring more and more workers, well, at a time when we're also deporting perhaps millions of workers over the next few years, people who are not in the United States properly, then that's going to make the labor shortage even worse. And that will push up wages, and that will be inflationary. Now, normally, when there's inflation, the Fed would increase interest rates. That's their job, to price stability and maximum employment. But of course, President Trump doesn't want the Fed to increase interest rates. President Trump has made it very clear that he wants the Fed to sharply cut interest rates. He has said that he would like to see the federal funds rate down somewhere near 1%, whereas right now it's above 4%. Of course, if the Fed did that, that would really kick off an inflationary boom in the U.S. that would lead to much higher rates of inflation. So what President Trump would like to see, and the reason he wants very badly to take over control of U.S. monetary policy, is first of all, he wants the Fed to cut interest rates sharply, even though inflation is moving higher. Now, let's say he succeeds in doing that. If he does take over the Fed and gets the Fed to cut interest rates, even though the inflation rate is moving higher, that's not going to accomplish his objective. That would only reduce the federal funds rate, the short-term interest rate. But if the short-term interest rates are cut very sharply, then that's going to spook investors in the bond market, because they will realize that very low interest rates in the U.S. will create a big economic boom in the U.S., and that will drive the inflation rates much higher. Mm-hmm. So no one's going to buy a government bond that yields 4% if the inflation rate, for instance, is 6%. So just cutting interest rates will not achieve President Trump's objective. He would also need the Fed to create money and buy government bonds. In other words, another round of quantitative easing. This would be round 4 or 5 or 6, I've lost track, since 2008, depending on how you count them. But in that way, if he has control over the Fed and he instructs the Fed to conduct a new round of quantitative easing, then the Fed could create as much money as necessary and buy government bonds and push up the price of the government bonds and drive their yields down to any level that the president desires. And that way he could not only lower the short-term interest rates represented by the federal funds rate, but he could also drive down the interest rates on 10-year government bonds, even 30-year government bonds, also to any level that he decided to do. And in that way, he could accomplish all of his objectives. He could have high tariffs and essentially ignore the inflation that all of this would cause and keep interest rates at a very low level. And this would spark off a great economic boom in the U.S. and probably quite an extraordinary boom in asset prices and wealth creation at the same time. So that's why taking over the Fed is so important to making his strategy successful.
So, Richard, if we could, let's just go over that just one more time to make it a little bit more explicit. You know, obviously, the Fed has control over the overnight rate. Just explain to us again how he goes about really controlling the 10-year, and in conjunction, why we also need to go back to QE in order to basically, let's say, provide a solid footing or more solid footing for the bond market.
Okay, so after 2008, and again, when the COVID crisis began, the Fed created both times multi-trillion dollars in just over a very short period of time. I think off the top of my head, I believe it was in the first quarter perhaps of 2020, the Fed created $2.8 trillion in just 90 days. And they used that money to buy government bonds to help finance the massive expansion of the U.S. government debt that was on a similar scale at that time that was to be used for the fiscal stimulus during the COVID period in the early days of COVID. So the Fed has the power to create limitless amounts of money. Now, since 1968, But before 1968, the Fed had owned gold to back the dollars that it created. But that year, President Johnson asked Congress to remove that requirement, and Congress did remove that requirement. So now there's no gold, backing for dollars. The Fed can, in effect, create as many dollars as it wishes to do.
Mm-hmm.
So if we started to have higher rates of inflation in the United States as a result of tariffs and reindustrialization and full employment in the U.S., then as the inflation rate moves up, investors would demand a higher yield on government bonds. Again, the bonds yields are typically move in line with the inflation rate. When inflation goes up, the bond yields go up because investors demand to be compensated for the inflation. President Trump doesn't want the 10-year government bond yield to go up because that's the yield that sets all of the other interest rates in the country. The mortgage rates and the car rates and the credit card rates are all based off the 10-year government bond yield. So to prevent this upward pressure on bond yields, he could have the Fed intervene by creating hundreds of billions, or if necessary, trillions of new dollars to buy trillions of dollars of government bonds and push up the price of all of those bonds. And the yield moves in the opposite direction of the price. So if the price goes up, the yields go down. And given that the Fed is free to create as much money as it wants, there's no limit as to how much money it could create. So there's no limit as to how high it could push bond prices. In other words, there's no limit as to how low it could drive down interest rates on the 10-year government bond.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that, Richard. I think it's just worth just going over again, because the mechanisms that this happens through, I think are important to understand and underscore. So let's go back to Lisa Cook and, in a way, how Trump can go about basically making this happen without having to outright fire any of the sitting Fed chairs.
Okay, so let's just discuss the structure of the Federal Reserve System. Of course, the Federal Reserve is in control of U.S. monetary policy. That means it decides on where the short-term interest rates will be, the federal funds rate, and it also decides on whether to create money through quantitative easing or to destroy money through quantitative tightening. Now, they make these decisions. The Fed meets the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee, meets about eight times a year to decide what it's going to do with interest rates and money creation or money destruction. And the Federal Reserve System, and this is important, it's a bit boring, but it's important. There are seven governors of the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, and all seven of them have a vote on the FOMC meeting every time it meets. In addition, separately, there are 12 Federal Reserve banks scattered all around the United States and the major centers: the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, of Kansas, San Francisco, Atlanta, and so on. Each of these 12 has a president. So there are 12 Federal Reserve Bank presidents. Now, at each FOMC meeting, all seven Fed governors have a vote, but only five presidents have a vote on a rotating basis, only five vote each year. So five presidents vote and seven Fed governors vote. That's a total vote of 12 votes. Now, the reason that the Fed governors are, here's why it's so important. Here's where Lisa Cook comes in. Right now, here's why the Fed governors are so important. With a majority of four out of seven Fed governors, then the Fed governors have the right to fire the Federal Reserve Bank presidents. If four out of seven if Federal Reserve governors, if four out of the seven Federal Reserve governors vote to fire a Federal Reserve Bank president, then with or without cause, then that president could be fired. So if President Trump has four governors out of seven on his side who are willing to do what he tells them to do, he can take over complete control over U.S. monetary policy by firing the Federal Reserve Bank presidents and replacing them with people who will do what he tells them to do. Right now, he has three out of the seven Federal Reserve governors on his side. Christopher Waller, he appointed, Michelle Bowman, he appointed, and very recently, after one Fed governor unexpectedly resigned 6 months before her term ended, her name was Adriana Kugler, that happened a few months ago, he replaced her with Stephen Moran, the one who wrote this blueprint paper that we discussed earlier. So he's got three out of seven governors now. If he gets one more, that means he will have complete control over U.S. monetary policy in the way that I've described above.
And just to interrupt for 1 second, if I may, Christopher Waller and Michelle Bowman also kind of showed their hand and their, let's say, allegiance to Trump recently, right?
That's right. In the meeting before last, the FOMC meeting before last, they dissented from the majority vote. The meeting before last, the FOMC decided not to change interest rates, but they voted in favor of cutting interest rates. So it's unusual for Fed governors to dissent from the majority decision, but they've already shown that they are on Team Trump because both of them would like to be appointed Federal Reserve chairman in May next year, if not sooner. In May next year, Fed Chairman Powell's term expires, and he will be replaced by someone that President Trump will appoint. And both of those people, Waller and Bowman, would like to be the next Fed chairman. So they are certainly going to do what President Trump wants them to do, which is to cut interest rates. And now he's appointed Stephen Moran, who's even more aggressive. And in the most recent FOMC meeting, where the Fed did cut the federal funds rate by 25 basis points, he dissented because he wanted them to cut by even more. I think he said he wanted them to cut by 50 basis points. So he's clearly pressing for much lower interest rates, as President Trump wants him to do. So that's three out of the seven governors. To get a majority, he needs four out of seven governors. So he's trying very hard to fire another Fed governor so he can appoint her replacement. That's Lisa Cook. A couple of months ago, it was alleged by someone in the administration, the housing department, someone overseeing the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, Bill Pulte, accused Lisa Cook of mortgage fraud. And President Trump then announced that if she didn't resign, he was going to fire her. And then he did fire her, but she took him to court. And so far, in two cases, the court ruled on her side and said that she couldn't be fired for cause. In this case, for one reason, because the allegations have not been proved in court. She hasn't been charged. The two courts sided with her. And President Trump then accelerated this and took it to the Supreme Court. And a couple of weeks ago, the Supreme Court decided not to decide on this issue until January. They said they needed to think about this and to have testimony taken, and they would do this in January. So Lisa Cook is still she's still a Fed governor, and she still gets to vote on the FOMC meetings, but all of this will probably be decided in January. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's decided in President Trump's favor, because President Trump has appointed the majority of the judges on the Supreme Court, or at least it's generally viewed that the six out of the nine justices on the Supreme Court are on Team Trump as well. So it wouldn't be at all surprising if ultimately they do sack Lisa Cook, and that would then give President Trump 4 out of 7 on the Federal Reserve Board, which would give him complete control over U.S. monetary policy, allowing him to slash short-term interest rates and in order and allowing him to command the Fed to launch more quantitative easing to push down long-term interest rates. And that would spark quite an economic boom and also quite an upward surge in asset prices. But it would also lead to high rates of inflation, and it would cause the US dollar to crash. As interest rates were slashed, the US dollar would be less attractive relative to other currencies with higher interest rates. So the value of the dollar would crash. So we could see an extraordinary boom in wealth with stock prices going very much higher and very rapid economic growth.
So Richard, when we think about how, let's say that the timing of that, obviously, you know, everybody would want to get on that train, that basically the QE train that really Wall Street has been so conditioned to react to. How do we think about the timing of that and what could come, you know, before we get to this place where Trump slashes rates and unleashes QE? Could we have a market crash before that?
So I would say that this decision a couple of weeks ago by the Supreme Court not to decide about on Lisa Cook until January has delayed what I imagine would have occurred even sooner if they had removed Lisa Cook last week, for instance. Then we would quickly have a new Fed governor who's on Team Trump, and the Fed would begin slashing interest rates sooner than it will now be able to. So there's been some delay. And as a result of that delay, I think we've seen some dollar strength over the last couple of weeks that we wouldn't have seen otherwise. I think that's part of the reason the dollar has been strengthening against other currencies, at least over the last couple of weeks. So we'll have to wait and see what the Supreme Court does decide in January and go from there. If they keep her on, if they decide against President Trump, then she will remain on the as a Federal Reserve governor. And the next big event then will be at the end of February. At the end of February, all 12 Federal Reserve Bank presidents, their term expires on the same day, all 12 of them, all the time. They are appointed for 5-year terms, and these terms all expire at the end of February every 5 years. And so this is the next big event. Who will become the next Federal Reserve Bank president? It's certain that the administration will be applying a lot of pressure to have Federal Reserve Bank presidents appointed who are aligned with his objectives. And then after that, the next big event is in May. In May, Chairman Powell's term as Fed chairman expires. His term's up. That's it. And so President Trump will appoint the next Federal Reserve chairman. Chairman, whoever Trump appoints, will be chairman of the Fed. But it's still complicated because even though Chairman Powell's term as chairman will expire, he will still have the right to remain on remain at the Federal Reserve as a Federal Reserve governor for 2 or 3 more years. So there'll be a real showdown during these next several months to see what's going to happen. Of course, President Trump would like for Chairman Powell to not only leave the Fed as chairman, but to leave as Fed governor as well. Normally, when a person's term as chairman of the Fed ends, that person normally leaves the Fed as if he no longer stays on as a Fed governor either. But if Chairman Powell wished to stay on, he could do that. You can imagine how angry that would make President Trump, still trying to get the fourth vote on the Fed governors. So we'll just have to see how all this plays out step by step. But in the end, I think that, you know, President Trump usually gets what President Trump wants.
Yeah.
And this is very certainly what he wants. And I think it's probably what he will get. And therefore, this is the most likely direction, in my opinion, that things are going to move in with the Fed, with the president effectively becoming Fed chairman.
Richard, you mentioned that the U.S. dollar would be very likely to fall. What are we measuring it against that it's going to fall, you know, in? Are we measuring it against gold? Are we measuring it against the DXY? Like, what are the other, let's say, benchmarks that we're measuring it against?
Almost everything, except perhaps the Chinese currency, which the Chinese government can control mm-hmm. and does control. It's effectively, they control it and keep it at whatever level they want. But the dollar would fall against all the free-floating currencies, the euro and the yen, and it would also keep flowing. It would also keep falling against gold and silver and all of the other commodities.
So if we, let's talk about that balance of what we mentioned kind of at the top of the show here. The idea that if we embark on this, you know, policy path of lower rates and more QE, what are the, let's say, the pros and the cons to that?
Okay, well, let's start with the cons and end with the pros. Well, the one con would be that it would increase income inequality, because as asset prices continue to move much higher, then of course the wealthy own most of the assets, and so they would benefit the most. Recently, I believe the newspapers were reporting that the wealth of Elon Musk, for example, is now exceeds $500 billion. We, in this sort of environment over the next couple of years, we could begin to see trillionaires in the United States. And I think that's negative, because that's not good for democracy. When people have such extraordinary amounts of wealth, then they have extraordinary amount of influence over the political system. And that's not the way the United States government is meant to be structured.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be democracy. So I view that as a negative. And also, it's better for income to be more broadly distributed, because trillionaires don't spend a lot of extra money only on things like yachts and airplanes. They don't eat that much more or buy that many more tennis shoes or TVs. We need the income to be more broadly distributed to have sustainable and solid, stable economic growth. And so that's a con. Another very important problem is that this would lead to a very big economic boom, which in itself would be a good thing. But the problem is most economic booms eventually end in economic bust. And the sort of economic boom that we're talking about in this scenario would be a very big boom and very possibly lead to a very big economic bust. Eventually, asset prices would become very inflated and credit would expand very rapidly. We would get to the point, something similar to what happened in 2008, when the American public simply didn't have enough income to continue financing all of the money that they had borrowed, and they would begin defaulting. And this would then spiral into a systemic financial sector crisis, something similar to what we saw in 2008. So this big boom would lead to a big bust, ultimately, and a replay of 2008 or even something worse a few years down the road. Now, moving on to the positives, actually, while it's common wisdom that credit booms lead to credit bust, I can see a scenario in which that doesn't happen in this case. No, President Trump, in February, by executive order, created a U.S. sovereign wealth fund, in which he intends to use to make America great again. Now, once he has taken control of the Fed and launches the next round of quantitative easing, it won't take him at all long to realize that he could use the Fed to finance his U.S. sovereign wealth fund. He could have the Fed create $1 trillion or even many trillion dollars, multi-trillion dollars over the coming few years and fund his U.S. sovereign wealth fund. Now, if this U.S. sovereign wealth fund really invested aggressively with its Fed funding, if it invested aggressively in the industries of the future, things like artificial intelligence and developing fusion, for instance, developing energy resources that are necessary to power the data centers that power AI, if it invested in things like quantum computing, robotics, nanotechnology, genetic engineering, biotech, then this could induce a technological revolution that could turbocharge U.S. economic growth and productivity and keep this economic boom from busting anytime within the near future. It could induce such an economic boom that it could power the U.S. economy for decades into the future, not only making the economy grow much more rapidly than it otherwise would do, but in the process, shoring up U.S. national security, ensuring that the United States remained the dominant economic, technological, and therefore military power. Currently, China is about to overtake the United States economically, technologically, and militarily, therefore. So U.S. national security is currently in danger. So one good thing that could come out of all of this is if the U.S. Sovereign Wealth Fund does invest very aggressively in future technologies, then that would ensure that the United States retains its geopolitical preeminence and would guarantee U.S. national security for generations to come. This is the sort of thing that I wrote about in my most recent book you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, The Money Revolution, How to Finance the Next American Century. Well, how to finance the next American century is for the U.S. government to invest in these new industries on a very, very aggressive scale. I advocated a multi-trillion dollar investment to be financed by the Federal Reserve over the next decade. And that seems to be the direction in which we're moving. Now, this would not only result in rapid economic growth and U.S. national security, but it would also result in technological breakthroughs and medical miracles that would radically enhance human well-being, possibly resulting in curing all the diseases and expanding life expectancy, but healthy life expectancy by decades or even longer. So this would be a very positive development if this is actually the direction that the president decides to take once he does have complete control of the Federal Reserve. And it would make his strategy, and it would allow him to achieve all of his objectives of making America great again.
Part of this as well is, something that you kind of laid out in this last video of yours, in this last presentation, is the idea that this is almost essential to win the AI race over China, right? So what do you see as the risks there if China, let's say, wins the AI race?
If China wins the AI race and develops super intelligence before the United States does, then China will rule the world. They will conquer the United States and every other country in the world, and we will be living under Chinese authoritarian rule. And that will be the end of liberty and democracy and all the things that Americans hold dear.
So how do you think they go about that, though, by, let's say, breaking, like, basically cyber attacks on all the other countries? Like, what do they have to gain by that?
Whoever develops the super intelligence first, then it's not a static point. Once AI reaches that level, it becomes exponentially more intelligent very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And whoever can obtain that first would have such an advantage in terms of developing weapons or of every description that any other rival couldn't possibly even defend itself or foresee the sort of attacks that would be carried out. There, in other words, the rest of the world would be defenseless against any Chinese takeover. Mm-hmm. And you can see how close China is. China had 5G years before the U.S. did. It has hypersonic missiles. The United States doesn't. It has control of rare earths materials. And it has expanded its electricity generating capacity extraordinarily rapidly. Since the year 2000, China has expanded its electricity generating capacity by 8 times. In 2000, the United States had twice as much electricity generating capacity as China did. And now China has 2.5 or 3 times as much as the U.S. does. China is developing lots of nuclear reactors. The United States is currently developing none. So we are on the verge of being overtaken by China. And that's what, regardless of what anyone thinks about the wisdom of government investment, and in wartime, the government has to play the leading role, as it always does. The United States government invested so much during World War II that it not only ended the Great Depression through all the military spending, but the spending was so great by the government that it created an economic boom that lasted for decades after the war ended. And in that government investment at the time is the thing that allowed the United States to win the war and to be the superpower for the last 80 years. And we're once again back in effectively a technology arms race, this time with China. China's government is investing very aggressively in these new technologies, and they have a plan. They have long-term plans. The United States has been very lax. How could the United States have allowed the Chinese to develop such a monopoly and control over rare earths when all of these rare earths are necessary for making the weapons that the United States needs to defend itself? Mm-hmm. Well, the United States should have had a plan. It didn't, and now it desperately needs one, and they better get moving as quickly as possible.
And going back to your point about China's rapid expansion of energy generation, energy is so tied to GDP that, like, you would think that it can be seen as such a necessary component to not only to growth, but also to maintaining that advantage in the world.
In the United States, the demand for electricity didn't grow for decades because the United States was deindustrializing and moving all of the factories abroad and relying more and more on services. So there wasn't really any growing demand for energy. But now suddenly, with the AI revolution, AI has to have electricity to run the data centers. Mm-hmm. And now everyone's woken up to the fact that the United States doesn't have enough electricity to power the data centers that our leading technology companies want to build over the next 5 years. So we're going to face electricity generation constraints that will hamper our attempts to win the AI race.
So, Richard, going back to, going back to this idea, is this basically the only possible course of action at this point?
Of course, there are always many different courses of action, but having national consensus on moving in the right direction is what is necessary to have a favorable outcome. Many mistakes could be made that cause us to fail and that would effectively cause, without trying to be overly dramatic, the end of the United States. Empires don't last forever, and wrong moves can result in collapse. Mm-hmm. I think we're now given how rapidly technology is increasing and how aggressively China is investing in new technologies, this is a very grave moment for the U.S. I've been calling for this sort of investment going back 15 years now. Mm-hmm. And at the time, people would say, well, that's an interesting idea that the government should invest in new industries and technologies, but that's never going to happen. Well, gradually, this is starting to happen. The 4 or 6 years ago, Congress passed the CHIPS and Science Act, which was directed at investing very large amounts of money in new industries and technologies. Now, President Trump has established a U.S. sovereign wealth fund. So, and also, what we're talking about is state-directed capitalism in the United States. You can just see what has happened. The U.S., as I mentioned, President Trump has established the U.S. sovereign wealth fund by executive order in February. He's put up this new trade regime in order to reindustrialize the United States. He's forcing many of the United States trading partners to invest hundreds of billions of dollars into the U.S., into projects of the president's own choosing. Now got the government backing rare earth minerals mining companies. The government's taken a golden share in U.S. Steel and a 10% equity stake in Intel. So all of this is showing that the country's moving in a direction of state-directed capitalism. Mm-hmm. And of course, many people would view that as a very undesirable outcome. Many of the same people are some of President Trump's most ardent supporters, I would imagine. And all I can say to these people and everyone is that in a wartime situation, it's absolutely necessary for the government to invest on an extremely aggressive scale to ensure that our side wins.
Richard, what do you think happens if we start going down this road and then, you know, the end of Trump's term comes up and whoever the next U.S. president ends up being is opposed to this path? How does that get reversed, and what do you think the consequences end up being?
If we don't move toward much greater investment in new industries and technologies, then we'll be eclipsed by China. And hopefully this happens in a very gradual manner, step by step, with the U.S. would lose its influence in Asia. So that would mean China would take over Taiwan, and most of our semiconductors that power artificial intelligence are made in Taiwan. So that would ensure that China would win the AI race. And then they would slowly, or perhaps not slowly, but they would become the dominant partner of Japan and South Korea and all of Asia. And their influence would just hopefully spread gradually and not too immediately painfully for the United States. But inevitably, they would replace the United States as the dominant power, and things would just get worse for Americans from there.
Yeah, it's certainly a very interesting path ahead that in some ways is very counterintuitive, but I can understand, you know, basically the need for investment into this growth. But when my only question is, when we have that type, or if we are able to bring manufacturing back to get to this point where we have lots of domestic manufacturing, who's going to be buying from the U.S.? Certainly it can't be just inside the U.S. that, you know, is sustainable, right? And if we have, you know, higher labor rates, higher costs because of less globalization, less, you know, shared costs through the world, or less optimization in supply chains, who ends up buying these products from the U.S.?
Well, the domestic demand in the United States is truly enormous. And could the U.S. demand would be sufficient for many years to absorb the new manufacturing capacity that the that would be developed. Again, last year the U.S. bought $1.2 trillion more from the rest of the world than it sold to the rest of the world. So that's $1.2 trillion that could be spent within the United States just there. That's a lot of spending power. One of the United States' greatest advantages in the geopolitical competition is the U.S. has tremendous amounts of purchasing power. The Americans' income is very high relative to the rest of the world. And that's allowed the United States to buy a lot of friends over the last 30 years by agreeing to have trade deficits with other countries. This has encouraged the other countries to cooperate with the United States. Now, but if we abandon this current arrangement where we are the buyers of last resort from other countries are no longer going to be as friendly or as cooperative as they have been in the past when the U.S. has been such a major purchaser of their goods and employer of their workers indirectly through the factories in Asian countries that make things to sell to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, Richard, I think that's a good place to kind of wrap up for today. I appreciate you explaining to us how you see these strategies, the moves that have been telegraphed already by Trump in this strategy to kind of bring the Fed more under his purview or his control. Is there anything that you'd like to perhaps leave our listeners to think about or to consider before we wrap up today?
I think we've covered the main points. In my work, I'm an economist. I produce a video newsletter called Macro Watch. Every couple of weeks, I make a new video presentation discussing something important happening in the global economy and how that's likely to impact asset prices. And in those presentations, I focus very much on macroeconomic events and how they'll affect wealth. In our conversation, we've veered very much into geopolitics and long-term scary scenarios. And I touch on those occasionally in my videos, but mostly it's more discussing macroeconomic developments and how they will affect wealth, share prices, property prices, interest rates, etc. For instance, if President Trump does take over the Fed, as I expect that he will, then this is going to create an economic boom and a surge in asset prices. That's more of the thing I focus on in Macro Watch. So I've been making these videos now for Macro Watch for 12 years. This is the 12th anniversary of Macro Watch this month. There are hundreds of hours of videos in the Macro Watch archives. So I hope your listeners will take a look at my website, which they can find on richardduncaneconomics.com. It's richardduncaneconomics.com. Check out MacroWatch. If they'd like to subscribe, they can subscribe at a 50% discount if they use the discount coupon code COMPETENT. If they click on the subscribe now button, they'll be prompted to put in a discount code. If they use COMPETENT, they can subscribe at a 50% discount. So I hope they'll visit the website and check that out. And at the very least, while they're there, they could sign up for my free blog.
Absolutely. And of course, for those that want to follow Richard as well on X, he's at Paper Money Econ. Richard, I appreciate the offer to the listeners as well as your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. I've enjoyed it and I look forward to the next time.
Absolutely. Me too.